But it's starting to happen just a little too frequently. And every time we try to follow him, there's some kind of ambush.
You think it's deliberate?
Tinian asked. It's beginning to look that way, isn't it?
Would this Martell put a friend in such danger?
Bevier sounded surprised. Martell doesn't have any friends, Sparhawk told him. Addis and Krager are hirelings, nothing more. They're useful, but he feels no particular attachment for them. I don't think he'd shed many tears if something happened to Krager. He began to pace up and down, staring thoughtfully at the floor. Maybe we can turn the tables on him. He looked at Calton. Why don't you let yourself be seen in the streets of Medell, he suggested. Don't take too many chances, but let people know you're in town.
Why not? Calton shrugged.
Tinian grinned. Martell and his hirelings don't know the rest of us, so we can sort of loiter along behind Calton without attracting attention. Is that the idea?
Sparhawk nodded. If they think Calton's alone, it might bring them out into the open. I'm getting a little tired of Martell's game, so maybe it's time for us to play a few of our own.
He looked at Bevier's cousin. How excited do the local authorities get about street brawls, my lord? He asked.
Lycian laughed. Medell is a seaport, Sir Sparhawk. Brawling is second nature to sailors. The authorities don't pay much attention to their little scuffles, except to remove the bodies, of course. Public sanitation, you understand.
Good. Sparhawk looked at his friends. You may not get a chance at Krager or Addis, but you might be able to divide Martell's attention. That could be what it takes to get Kurek and Sefreni and me aboard a ship unnoticed. I'd rather not have to keep looking over my shoulder when we get to Cypria.
About the only tricky part is going to be getting you to the harbor without being seen, Calton said.
It won't be necessary to go to the harbor, Lycian said. I have some warehouses on the river about 5 miles from here. A fair number of independent sea captains deliver cargoes to me there, and I'm sure arrangements for your passage can be made without any need for going into the city.
Thank you, my lord, Sparhawk said. That solves a problem.
When do you plan to leave? Tinian asked.
I don't see much point in delaying.
Tomorrow, then,
Sparhawk nodded.
I need to talk with you, Sparhawk, Sophronia said. Would you mind coming to my room?
He followed her out of the door, slightly puzzled. Is it something we can't discuss in front of the others? He asked her.
It might be better if they don't hear us arguing.
Are we going to argue?
Probably.
She opened the door to her room and led him inside. Flute sat cross-legged on the bed, her dark eyebrows knit in concentration as she wove the intricate mesh of a cat's cradle out of a strand of wool yarn. It was far more complex than the one Talon had made when he had demonstrated it to her. She looked up, smiled at them, and proudly extended her little hands to show them her handiwork.
She'll be going with us, Sophronia said.
Absolutely not, Sparhawk said sharply.
I told you we'd argue about this. It's an absurd idea, Sophronia. We all do many absurd things, dear one.
She smiled affectionately at him. Don't do that, he said. You're not going to win me over that way.
Don't be tiresome, Sparhawk. You've been around her long enough to know that she always does what she decides to do, and she's decided that she's going with us to Rendor.
She won't, if I have anything to say about it.
That's the whole point, Sparhawk. You don't. You're dealing with something you can't understand. She's going to come with us in the end anyway, so why not just give in gracefully?
Gracefulness is not one of my strong points.
I've noticed.
All right, Sophronia, he said flatly. Just who is she anyway? You recognized her the first moment we saw her, didn't you?
Of course.
Why, of course? She's only about 6 years old, and you haven't left us Pandians for generations. How could you possibly know her?
She sighed. Eline logic always clouds an issue with facts. The child and I are kindred in a rather peculiar sense of the word. We know each other in a way you couldn't begin to comprehend.
Thanks, he said dryly.
I'm not belittling your intelligence, dear one, she told him, but there's a part of Styric life you're not prepared to accept, either intellectually or philosophically.
He frowned slightly, his eyes narrowed in thought. All right, Sophronia, he said. Let me have a try at the Aline logic you're so fond of dismissing. Flute is a child, hardly more than a baby. The little girl made a face at him. He ignored that and went on. She suddenly appeared in an uninhabited region near the Arcian border, far from any kind of human habitation. We tried to leave her at the nunnery south of Dara, and she not only managed to escape, but also got a goodly distance ahead of us, even though we were traveling at a gallop. Then she somehow managed to persuade Farron to let her on his back, and Farron won't let anybody near him except me unless I tell him to. When she met Dolmont, you could tell by his face that he sensed something very unusual about her. Not only that, you bully full-grown knights like a drill sergeant, but any time Flute decides to do something or go someplace, you give in without a fight. Wouldn't you say that all of that suggests that she's not an ordinary child?
You're the one who's exercising his logic. I wouldn't dream of interfering.
All right, then. Let's see where logic takes us. I've seen a fair number of Styrix. With the exception of you and the other magicians, they're all fairly primitive and not very bright. No offense intended, of course.
Of course.
Her expression was amused. Since we've already established the fact that Flute is not an ordinary child, what does that leave us?
What would be your guess, Sparhawk?
Since she's not ordinary, she must be special. In Styricum, that can only mean one thing. She's a magician. Nothing else could explain her. She applauded ironically.
Excellent, Sparhawk,
she congratulated him. But that's impossible, Sophronia. She's only a child. She hasn't had time to learn the secrets.
Some few are born with that knowledge. Besides, she's older than she looks.
How old?
You know I won't tell you that. The knowledge of the exact moment of one's birth can be a powerful weapon in the hands of an enemy.
A disturbing thought came to him.
You're preparing for your own death, aren't you, Sophronia? If we fail, the 12 Pandians who were in the throne room with you will die, one by one, and then you'll die too. You're preparing Flute to be your successor.
She laughed.
Now that, dear Sparhawk, is a very interesting idea. I'm surprised you came up with it, considering the fact that you're an Aline.
That's a very irritating habit you've picked up lately, you know. Don't try to be mysterious with me, Sophronia. And don't treat me like a child just because I'm an Aline.
I'll try to remember that. You'll agree to let her come with us, then.
Do I have any choice?
No. As a matter of fact, you don't.
They rose early the next morning and gathered in the dew-drenched yard in front of Marquis Lycian's house. The newly risen sun was very bright, and it slanted down through the trees, casting the peculiarly bluish-colored shadows of early morning. I'll get word to you from time to time, Sparhawk told those who were remaining behind. Be careful down there, Sparhawk, Kelton said. I'm always careful. Sparhawk swung himself up onto Farron's back.
Godspeed, Sir Sparhawk,
Bevier said. Thank you, Bevier. Sparhawk looked around at the other knights. Don't be so glum, gentlemen, he told them. If we're lucky, this won't take very long. He looked at Kelton again. If you run into Martell, give him my regards. Kelton nodded. With an axe in the face, I think. Marquis Lycian mounted a fat bay horse and led the way out onto the road which passed his house. The morning was crisp, though not actually cold. Spring, Sparhawk decided, was not very far off. He shifted his shoulders slightly. The sober businessman's doublet Lycian had lent him did not really fit very well. It bound in some places and was uncomfortably loose in others.
We'll turn off just up ahead,
Lycian told them. There's a track through the woods that leads down to my wharves, and the little settlement that's grown up around them. Will you want me to bring your horses back after you've gone on board ship?
No, my lord, Sparhawk replied. I think we'll take them with us. We don't know exactly what's going to happen in Rendor. We might need dependable mounts, and I've seen what passes for a horse in Cypria. What Lycian had modestly called a little settlement turned out to be a fair-sized village, complete with shipyards, houses, inns, and taverns. A dozen vessels were moored at the wharves, with longshoremen swarming over them. Quite an operation, my lord, Sparhawk said as they rowed down the muddy street toward the river.
One has had a certain success, Lycian said, deprecatingly. He smiled. Besides, I save enough in moorage fees to offset more than the cost of keeping the place up. He looked around. Why don't you and I step into that tavern over there, Sir Sparhawk? He suggested. The independent sea captains favor that one.
All right, Sparhawk agreed.
I'll introduce you as Master Clough, Lycian said as he swung down from his bay. It's not much of a name, I'll admit, but it's fairly nondescript, and I've discovered that seafaring men love to talk. But they're not always very selective in their choice of listeners. I've gathered that you might prefer to keep this business of yours more or less confidential.
You're perceptive, my lord, Sparhawk replied, also dismounting.
This shouldn't take too long, he said to Curic and Zephrenia.
Isn't that what you said the last time you went to Rendor?
Curic asked him.
We can all hope that this time might be different.
Lycian led the way into a rather sedate wharfside tavern. The ceiling was low, with dark, heavy beams decorated here and there with ship's lanterns. There was a broad window near the front, and golden morning sunlight streamed in through it, setting the fresh straw on the floor to gleaming. Several substantial-looking men of middle years sat at a table by the window, talking over brimming tankards. They looked up as the Marquis led Sparhawk to their table.
My lord,
one of them respectively greeted Lycian.
Gentlemen, Lycian said, this is Master Clough, an acquaintance of mine. He asked me to introduce him.
They all looked at Sparhawk inquiringly.
I have a bit of a problem, gentlemen, Sparhawk told them. May I join you?
Have a seat.
One of the sea captains, a solid-looking man with silver-shot hair, invited.
I'll leave you, gentlemen, then, Lycian said. There's something that needs my attention.
He inclined his head slightly, turned, and went back out of the tavern.
He probably wants to see if there's some way he can raise the mooring fees, one of the captains said, wryly. My name's Sorgi,
the captain with the curly hair introduced himself to Sparhawk.
What's this problem you mentioned, Master Clough?
Sparhawk coughed slightly, as if a little embarrassed. Well, he said, it all started a few months ago. I happened to hear about a lady who lives not far from here, he began, embellishing as he went along. Her father is old and very wealthy, so the lady stands to inherit a sizable estate. One of my problems has always been the fact that I have some expensive tastes and very little in my purse to support them. It occurred to me that a rich wife might solve that problem.
That makes sense, Captain Sorgi said.
That's about the only reason I can think of for getting married at all.
I couldn't agree more, Sparhawk replied.
Anyway, I wrote her a letter, pretending that we had some mutual friends, and I was a little surprised when she answered my letter with a great deal of warmth. Our letters grew more and more friendly, and she finally invited me to call on her. I went even deeper in debt to my tailor, and set out for her father's house in high spirits and splendid new clothes.
Sounds to me as if everything was going according to plan, Master Clough, Sorgi said. What's this problem of yours?
I'm just getting to that, Captain. The lady is of middle years and very wealthy. If she were even remotely presentable, someone would have snapped her up years ago, so I didn't have my hopes too high on that score. I assumed that she was plain,
perhaps even homely. I had not, however, expected a horror. He feigned a shudder. Gentlemen, I cannot even describe her to you. No matter how rich she was, it wouldn't have been worth waking up to that every morning. We spoke together briefly, about the weather, I think, and then I made my apologies and left. She has no brothers, so I wasn't worried about the possibility of someone looking me up to object to my bad manners. What I didn't count on, though, was all her cousins. She's got a whole platoon of them, and they've been following me for weeks now. They don't want to kill you, do they? Sorgi asked. No, Sparhawk replied in an anguished tone. They want to drag me back and force me to marry her. The captains all roared with laughter, pounding on the table in glee.
I think you've outsmarted yourself, Master Clough, one of them said, wiping the tears of mirth from his eyes.
Sparhawk nodded glumly. You're probably right, he admitted.
You should have found some way to get a look at her before you sent the first letter, Sorgi grinned.
I know that now, Sparhawk agreed. Anyhow, I think it's time I left the country for a while until the cousins stop looking for me. I've got a nephew living in Cypria and Rendor who's been doing fairly well of late. I'm sure I can impose on him until I can get my feet on the ground again. Is it possible that one of you gentlemen might be sailing there soon? I'd like to book passage for myself and a couple of family retainers. I'd go to the main docks in Medell, but I've got a strong feeling that the cousins are watching them.
What say you, gentlemen? Captain Sorgi said, expansively. Shall we help this good fellow out of his predicament?
I'm going to Rendor right enough, one of the others replied. But I'm committed to Jirok.
Sorgi thought about it.
I was going to Jirok myself, he mused, and then on to Cypria, but I might be able to rearrange my schedule just a bit.
I won't be able to help, a rough-voiced sea captain growled. My ship's having her bottom scraped. I can give you some advice, though. If these cousins are watching the main wharves in Medell, they're probably watching these as well. Everybody in town knows about Lycian's docks here.
He tugged at one earlobe.
I've smuggled a few people out of a few places in my time, when the price was right.
He looked at the captain who was bound for Jirok.
When do you sail, Captain Mabon?
With the noon tide.
And you?
The helpful captain asked Sorgi.
The same.
Good. If the cousins are watching the docks here, they may try to hire a ship and follow our bachelor friend. Have him openly board Mabon's ship. Then, when you're down river a ways and out of sight, transfer him to Sorgi's ship. If the cousins decide to follow, Mabon can lead them off toward Jirok, and Master Clough will be safe on his way to Cypria. That's the way I'd do it.
You've got a very ingenious mind, my friend, Sorgi laughed. Are you sure that people are the only things you've smuggled in the past?
We've all avoided customs officers from time to time, haven't we, Sorgi?
The rough-voiced captain said.
We live at sea. Why should we pay taxes to support the kingdoms of the landsmen? I'd gladly pay taxes to the king of the ocean, but I can't seem to find his palace.
Well said, my friend, Sorgi applauded.
Gentlemen, Sparhawk said, I'm eternally in your debt.
Not exactly eternally, Master Clough. A man who admits to having financial difficulties pays for his passage before he boards. He does on my ship, at least.
Would you accept half here and half when we reach Cypria? Sparhawk countered.
I'm afraid not, my friend. I like you well enough, but I'm sure you can see my position in the matter.
Sparhawk sighed. We have horses, he added. I suppose you'll charge extra to carry them as well.
Naturally.
I was afraid of that. The loading of Farron, Sophrenius Palfrey, and Kirik's stout gelding took place behind a screen of sailcloth Sorgi's sailors were ostensibly mending. Shortly before noon, Sparhawk and Kirik boarded the ship bound for Jirok. They moved openly up the gangway, followed by Sophrenia, who carried flute in her arms.
Captain Mabon greeted them on the quarterdeck.
"Ah," he grinned, "here's our reluctant bridegroom. Why don't you and your friends walk around the deck until we sail? Give all the cousins plenty of chances to see you."
"I've had a few second thoughts about this, Captain Mabon," Sparhawk said. "If the cousins hire a ship and follow, and if they catch up with you, it's going to be fairly obvious that I'm not on board."
"Nobody's going to catch up with me, Master Clough," the captain laughed. "I've got the fastest ship on the inner sea. Besides, it's obvious that you don't know very much about seafaring etiquette. Nobody boards another man's ship at sea unless he's prepared for a fight. It's just not done."
"Oh," Sparhawk said. "I didn't know that. We'll stroll around the deck, then."
"Bridegroom?"
Sophronia murmured as they moved away from the captain. "It's a long story," Sparhawk told her.
"There seems to be a fair number of these long stories cropping up lately. Someday, we'll have to sit down so that you can tell them to me.
Someday, perhaps."
"Flute,"
Sophronia said quite firmly.
"Come down from there."
Sparhawk looked up. The little girl was halfway up a rope ladder stretching from the rail to the yardarm. She pouted just a bit, then did as she was told. "You always know exactly where she is, don't you?" he asked Sophronia.
"Always," she replied.
The transfer from one ship to the other took place in mid-river, some distance downstream from Lycian's wharves, and was concealed by a great deal of activity on both ships. Captain Sorghi quickly bustled his passengers below decks to get them out of sight, and then the two ships proceeded sedately downriver, bobbing side by side like two matrons returning home from church.
"We're passing the wharves of Medell," Sorghi called down the companionway to them some short time later. "Keep your face out of sight, Master Clough, or I may have a deck full of your betrothed's cousins on my hands."
"This is really making me curious, Sparhawk," Sophronia said. "Couldn't you give me just the tiniest clue?"
"I made up a story," he shrugged. "It was lurid enough to seize the attention of a group of sailors."
"Sparhawk's always been very good at making up stories," Kirik observed. "He used to lie himself in and out of trouble regularly when he was a novice."
The grizzled squire was seated on a bunk, with a drowsing flute nestled in his lap.
"You know," he said quietly, "I never had a daughter. They smell better than little boys, don't they?"
Sophronia burst out laughing.
"Don't tell Aslade," she cautioned. "She may decide to try for one."
Kirik rolled his eyes upward in dismay.
"Not again," he said. "I don't mind babies around the house, but I couldn't bear the morning sickness again."
About an hour later, Sorghi came down the companionway.
"We're clearing the mouth of the estuary now," he reported, "and there's not a single vessel to the rear. I'd say that you've made good your escape, Master Clough."
"Thank God," Sparhawk replied fervently.
"Tell me, my friend," Sorghi said thoughtfully, "is the lady really as ugly as you say?"
"Captain Sorghi, you wouldn't believe how ugly."
"Maybe you're a bit too delicate, Master Clough. The sea's getting colder, my ship's getting old and tired, and the winter storms are making my bones ache. I could stand a fair amount of ugliness if the lady's estate happened to be as large as you say. I might even consider returning some of your passage money in exchange for a letter of introduction. Maybe you overlook some of her good qualities."
"We could talk about that, I suppose," Sparhawk conceded.
"I need to go topside," Sorghi said. "We're far enough past the city that it's safe for you and your friends to come on deck now."
He turned and went back up the companionway.
"I think I can save you all the trouble of telling me that long story you mentioned earlier,"
Sophronia told Sparhawk.
"You didn't actually use that tired old fable about the ugly heiress, did you?"
He shrugged. "As Vanyan says, the old ones are the best."
"Oh, Sparhawk, I'm disappointed in you. How are you going to avoid giving that poor captain the imaginary lady's name?"
I'll think of something. Why don't we go up on deck before the sun sets?
Keurig spoke in a whisper. I think the child's asleep, he said. I don't want to wake her. You two go on ahead.
Sparhawk nodded and led Sophronia out of the cramped cabin.
I always forget how gentle he is, Sophronia said softly.
Sparhawk nodded. He's the best and kindest man I know, he said simply. If it weren't for class distinctions, he'd have made an almost perfect knight.
Is class really all that important?
Not to me it isn't, but I didn't make the rules. They emerged on deck in the slanting, late-afternoon sunlight. The breeze blowing offshore was brisk, catching the tops of the waves and turning them into sun-splash froth. Captain Mabin's vessel, bound for Jurok, was heeling over in that breeze on a course almost due west through the broad channel of the Arcian Strait. Her sails bellied out, snowy white in the afternoon sun, and she ran before the wind like a skimming seabird. How far do you make it to Cypria, Captain Sorghi? Sparhawk asked as he and Sophronia stepped up onto the quarterdeck.
150 leagues, Master Clough, Sorghi replied. 3 days, if this wind holds.
That's good time, isn't it? Sorghi grunted.
We could have made better if this poor old tub didn't leak so much.
Sparhawk,
Sophronia gasped, taking him urgently by the arm.
What is it?
He looked at her in concern. Her face had gone deathly pale.
Look,
she pointed. Some distance from where Captain Mabin's graceful ship was running through the Arcian Strait, a single, densely black cloud had appeared in an otherwise unblemished sky. It seemed somehow to be moving against the wind, growing larger and more ominously black by the moment. Then it began to swirl, ponderously at first, but then faster and faster. As it spun, a long, dark finger twitched and jerked down from its center, reaching down and down until its inky tip touched the roiling surface of the strait. Tons of water were suddenly drawn up into the swirling maw as the vast funnel moved erratically across the heaving sea.
Waterspout!
The lookout shouted down from the mast. The sailors rushed to the rail to gape in horror at the swirling spout. Inexorably, the vast thing bore down on Mabin's helpless ship, and then the vessel, which suddenly appeared very tiny, vanished in the seething funnel. Chunks and pieces of her timbers spun out of the great waterspout hundreds of feet in the air to settle with agonizing slowness to the surface again. A single piece of sail fluttered down like a stricken white bird. Then, as suddenly as they had come, the black cloud in its deadly waterspout was gone. So was Mabin's ship. The surface of the sea was littered with debris, and a vast cloud of white gulls appeared, swooping and diving over the wreckage as if to mark the vessel's passing. Chapter 18 Captain Sorghi combed the wreckage-strewn water where Maven's ship had gone down until after dark, but he found no survivors. Then, sadly, he turned his ship southeasterly again, setting his course toward Cypria. Sophronia sighed and turned from the rail.
Let's go below, Sparhawk.
He nodded and followed her down the companionway. Keurig had lighted a single oil lamp, and it swung from a low overhead beam, filling the small, dark-paneled compartment with swaying shadows. Flute had awakened, and she sat at the bolted-down table in the center of the cabin, looking suspiciously at the bowl sitting in front of her.
It's just stew, little girl, Keurig was saying to her. It won't hurt you.
She delicately dipped her fingers into the thick gravy and lifted out a dripping chunk of meat. She sniffed at it, then looked questioningly at the squire.
Salt pork, he told her.
She shuddered and dropped the chunk back into the gravy. Then she firmly pushed the bowl away.
Styrix don't eat pork, Keurig,
Sophronia told him. The ship's cook said that this is what the sailors eat,
he said defensively. He looked at Sparhawk. Was the captain able to find any survivors from the other ship?
Sparhawk shook his head. The waterspout tore it all to pieces.
The same thing probably happened to the crew. It's lucky we weren't on board that one.
Very lucky, Zephrenia agreed. Waterspouts are like tornadoes. They don't appear out of completely clear skies, and they don't move against the wind or change direction the way that one did. It was being consciously directed.
Magic, Kyrick said. Is that really possible? To call up weather like that, I mean.
I don't think I could do it.
Who did, then?
I don't know for certain.
Her eyes, however, showed a certain suspicion. Let's get it out into the open, Zephrenia, Sparhawk said. You've guessed something, haven't you? Her expression grew a bit more certain.
In the past few months, we've had several encounters with a hooded figure in a steric robe. You saw it several times in Simura, and it tried to have us ambushed on our way to Barata. Styrics seldom cover their faces. Have you ever noticed that?
Yes, but I don't quite make the connection.
This thing had to cover its face, Sparhawk. It's not human.
He stared at her. Are you sure?
I can't be absolutely positive until I see its face, but the evidence is beginning to pile up, wouldn't you say?
Could Anius actually do something like that?
It's not Anius. He might know a little rudimentary magic, but he couldn't begin to raise a thing like that. Only Azash could have done it. He's the only one who dares to summon such beings. The younger gods will not, and even the other elder gods have forsworn the practice.
Why would Azash want to kill Captain Mabin and his crew?
The ship was destroyed because the creature thought that we were on board.
That goes a little far, Zephrenia.
Kyrick objected skeptically.
If it's so powerful, why did it sink the wrong boat?
The creatures of the underworld are not very sophisticated, Kyrick, she replied. Our simple ruse may have deceived it. Power and wisdom don't always go hand in hand. Many of the greatest magicians of Styricum were as stupid as stumps.
I don't quite follow this, Sparhawk admitted with a puzzled frown. What we're doing has nothing to do with Zemok. Why would Azash go out of his way to help Anius?
It may be that there isn't any connection. Azash always has his own motives. It's quite possible that what he's doing has nothing to do with Anius at all.
It doesn't wash, Zephrenia. If you're right about this thing, it's been working for Martell, and Martell works for Anius.
Are you sure that the creature is working for Martell, and not the other way around? Azash can see the shadows of the future. One of us might be a danger to him. The seeming alliance between Martell and the creature may be no more than a matter of convenience.
He began to gnaw worriedly at a fingernail. That's all I need, he said. Something else to worry about.
Then a thought struck him. Wait a minute. Do you remember what the ghost of Lachis said? That darkness was at the gate, and that Alana was our only hope of light? Could Azash be that darkness?
She nodded.
It's possible.
If that's the case, then wouldn't it be Alana he's trying to destroy? She's totally protected by that crystal that encases her. But if something happens to us before we can find a way to heal her, she'll die too. Maybe that's why Azash has joined forces with the primate.
Aren't you both stretching things a bit? Kyrick asked. You're basing a great deal of speculation on a single incident.
It doesn't hurt to be ready for eventualities, Kyrick, Sparhawk replied. I hate surprises.
The squire grunted and rose to his feet. You two must be hungry, he said. I'll go down to the galley and get you some supper. We can talk more while you're eating.
No pork,
Zephrenia told him firmly.
Bread and cheese, then, he suggested, and maybe some fruit.
That would be fine, Kyrick. You'd probably better bring enough for Flute as well. I know she's not going to eat that stew.
That's all right, he said. I'll eat it for her. I don't have the same kind of prejudices that you Styrics do.
It was overcast when they reached the port city of Cypria 3 days later. The cloud cover was high and thin, and there was no trace of moisture in it. The city was low, with squat white buildings thickly walled to ward off the heat of the southern sun. The wharves jutting out into the harbor were constructed of stone, since Rendor was a kingdom largely devoid of trees. Sparhawk and the others came up on deck, wearing hooded black robes, just as the sailors were mooring Captain Sorghi's ship to one of the wharves. They went up the three steps to the quarterdeck to join the curly-haired seamen.
"Get some fenders between our side and that wharf!"
Sorghi roared at the seamen, who were snubbing off the mooring lines. He shook his head in disgust.
"I have to tell them that every single time we dock," he muttered. "All they can think about when we make port is the nearest alehouse."
He looked at Sparhawk.
"Well, Master Clough," he said, "have you changed your mind?"
"I'm afraid not, Captain," Sparhawk replied, setting down the bundle containing his spare clothing. "I'd like to oblige you, but the lady I mentioned seems to have all her hopes pinned on me. It's for your own good, actually. If you show up at her house with an introduction from me, her cousins might decide to wring my location out of you. Being wrung is not my idea of a good time. Besides, I don't want to take any chances." Sorghi grunted. Then he looked at them all curiously.
"Where did you come by this Rendor's clothing?"
"I did some bargaining in your forecastle yesterday," Sparhawk shrugged, plucking at the front of the hooded black robe he wore. "Some of your sailors like to be unobtrusive when they make port here in Rendor."
"How well I know," Sorghi said wryly. "I spent 3 days looking for the ship's cook the last time I was in Jirok."
He looked at Sophronia, who was also robed in black and wore a heavy veil across her face.
"Where did you find anything to fit her?" he asked. "None of my sailors are that small."
"She's very adept with her needle." Sparhawk did not think it necessary to explain exactly how Sophronia had changed the color of her white robe. Sorghi scratched at his curly hair.
"I can't for the life of me understand why most Rendors wear black," he said. "Don't they know that it's twice as hot?"
"Maybe they haven't realized that yet," Sparhawk replied. "Rendors are none too bright in the first place, and they've only been here for 5,000 years. Sorghi laughed.
"And maybe that's it," he said. "Good fortune here in Cypria, Master Clough," he said. "If I happen to run across any cousins, I'll tell them that I've never heard of you."
"Thank you, Captain," Sparhawk said, clasping Sorghi's hand. "You have no idea how much I appreciate that." They led their horses down the slanting gangway to the wharf. At Keurig's suggestion, they covered their saddles with blankets to conceal the fact that they were not of Rendorish construction. Then, they all tied their bundles to their saddles, mounted, and moved away from the harbor at an unobtrusive walk. The streets were teeming with Rendors. The city dwellers sometimes wore lighter-colored clothing, but the desert people were all dressed in unrelieved black and had their hoods up. There were few women in the street, and they were all veiled. Sophronia rode subserviently behind Sparhawk and Keurig, with her hood pulled far forward and her veil drawn tightly across her nose and mouth. "You know the customs here, I see," Sparhawk said back over his shoulder.
"I was here many years ago," she replied, drawing her robe around Flute's knees.
"How many years?"
"Would you like to have me tell you that Cypria was only a fishing village then?" she asked archly. 20 or so mud huts."
He looked back at her sharply. "Sophronia, Cypria's been a major seaport for 1,500 years.
"My," she said, "has it really been that long? It seems like only yesterday. Where does the time go?"
"That's impossible," she laughed gaily.
"How gullible you can be sometimes, Sparhawk," she said. "You know I'm not going to answer that kind of question, so why keep trying?"
He suddenly felt more than a little sheepish. "I suppose I asked for that, didn't I?" he admitted.
"Yes, you did."
Keurig was grinning broadly.
Go ahead and say it, Sparhawk told him sourly. Say what, my lord? Kirik's eyes were wide and innocent.
They rode up from the harbor, mingling with robed Rendors in the narrow, twisting streets. Although the overcast veiled the sun, Sparhawk could still feel the heat radiating out from the white-plastered walls of the houses and shops. He could also catch the familiar scents of Rendor. The air was close and dusty, and there was the pervading odor of mutton simmering in olive oil and pungent spices. There was the cloying fragrance of heavy perfumes, and overlaying it all was the persistent reek of the stockyards. Near the center of town, they passed the mouth of a narrow alley. A chill touched Sparhawk, and suddenly, as clearly as if they were actually ringing out their call, he seemed once again to hear the sound of the bells.
Something wrong? Kirik asked as he saw his lord shudder.
That's the alley where I saw Martell last time. Kirik peered up the alley.
Tight quarters in there, he noted.
That's all that kept me alive, Sparhawk replied. They couldn't come at me all at once.
Where are we going, Sparhawk?
Sophronia asked from the rear. To the monastery where I stayed after I was wounded, he replied. I don't think we want to be seen in the streets. The abbot and most of the monks out there are Arcian, and they know how to keep secrets.
Will I be welcome there? She asked dubiously.
Arcian monks are conservative, and they have certain prejudices where Styrix are concerned.
This particular abbot is a bit more cosmopolitan, Sparhawk assured her, and I have a few suspicions about his monastery anyway.
Oh?
I don't think these monks are entirely what they seem, and I wouldn't be at all surprised to find a secret armory inside the monastery, complete with burnished armor, blue surcoats, and a variety of weapons.
Cyrenix? She asked, a bit surprised.
The Pandians aren't the only ones who want to keep an eye on Rendor, he replied.
What's that smell? Kirik asked as they approached the western outskirts of town.
The stockyards, Sparhawk told him. A great deal of beef is shipped out of Cypria.
Do we have to go through any kind of a gate to get out?
Sparhawk shook his head. The city walls were pulled down during the suppression of the Ashandis heresy. The local people didn't bother to rebuild them. They emerged from the narrow street they were following into acre upon acre of stock pens filled with bawling, scrubby-looking cows. It was late afternoon by now, and the overcast had begun to take on a silvery sheen.
How much farther to the monastery? Kirik asked.
A mile or so.
It's quite a distance from that alley back there, isn't it?
I noticed that myself about 10 years ago.
Why didn't you take shelter someplace closer?
There wasn't any place safe. I could hear the bells from the monastery, so I just kept following the sound. It gave me something to think about.
You could have bled to death.
That same thought crossed my mind a few times that night.
Gentlemen, Sophronia said, do you suppose we could move along? The night comes on very quickly here in Rendor, and it gets cold in the desert after the sun goes down.
The monastery lay beyond the stockyards on a high, rocky hill. It was surrounded by a thick wall, and the gate was closed. Sparhawk dismounted before the gate and tugged on a stout cord hanging beside it. A small bell tinkled inside. After a moment, the shutter of a narrow, barred window cut into the stones beside the gate opened. The brown-bearded face of a monk peered out warily.
Good evening, brother, Sparhawk said. Do you suppose I might have a word with your abbot?
Can I give him your name?
Sparhawk. He might remember me. I stayed here for a time a few years back.
Wait, the monk said brusquely, closing the shutter again.
Not very cordial, is he? Kirik said.
Churchmen aren't really welcome in Rendor, Sparhawk replied. A bit of caution is probably only natural. They waited as the twilight faded. Then the shutter opened again.
Sir Sparhawk! A voice more suited to a parade ground than a religious community boomed. "My Lord Abbot," Sparhawk replied. "Wait there a moment. We'll open the gate." There was a rattling of chains and the grating sound of a heavy bar sliding through thick iron rings. Then the gate ponderously swung open, and the abbot came out to greet them. He was a bluff, hearty-looking man with a ruddy face and an imposing black beard. He was quite tall, and his shoulders were massive. "It's good to see you again, my friend," he said, clasping Sparhawk's hand in a crushing grip. "You're looking well. You seemed a bit pale and wan when you left the last time you were here." "It's been 10 years, my lord," Sparhawk pointed out. "In that length of time, a man either heals or dies." "So he does, Sir Sparhawk, so he does. Come inside and bring your friends." Sparhawk led Farron through the gate with Sophrenia and Curic close behind. There was a court inside, and the walls surrounding it were as bleak as those surrounding the monastery. They were unadorned by the white mortar customary on the walls of Rendorish buildings, and the windows which pierced them were perhaps a trifle narrower than monastic architecture would have dictated. They would, Sparhawk noted professionally, make excellent vantage points for archers. "How can I help you, Sparhawk?" the abbot asked. "I need refuge again, my lord abbot," Sparhawk replied. "That's getting to be sort of a habit, isn't it?" The abbot grinned at him. "Who's after you this time?" he asked. "No one that I know of, my lord, and I think I'd like to keep it that way. Is there some place we can talk privately?" "Of course." The abbot turned to the brown-bearded monk who had first opened the shutter. "See to their horses, brother." It was not a request, but had all the crispness of a military command. The monk straightened noticeably, though he did not quite salute. "Come along, then, Sparhawk," the abbot boomed, clapping the big knight on the shoulder with one meaty hand. Curic dismounted and went to help Sophrenia. She handed flute down to him and slipped from her saddle. The abbot led them on through the main door and into a vaulted stone corridor, dimly lighted at intervals by small oil lamps. Perhaps it was the scent of the oil, but the place had a peculiar odor of sanctity and of safety about it. That smell sharply reminded Sparhawk of the night 10 years before. "The place hasn't changed much," he noted, looking around. "The church is timeless, Sir Sparhawk," the abbot replied sententiously, "and her institutions tried to match that quality." At the far end of the corridor, the abbot opened a severely simple door, and they followed him into a book-lined room with a high ceiling and an unlighted charcoal brazier in the corner. The room was quite comfortable-looking, far more so than the studies of abbots in the monasteries of the north. The windows were made of thick, triangular pieces of glass, joined with strips of lead, and they were draped in pale blue. The floor was strewn with white sheepskin rugs, and the unmade bed in the far corner was quite a bit wider than the standard monastic cot. The jammed bookcases reached from floor to ceiling. "Please, sit down," the abbot said, pointing at several chairs standing in front of a table piled high with documents. "Still trying to catch up, my lord?" Sparhawk smiled, pointing at the documents and taking one of the chairs. The abbot made a wry face. "I give it a try every month or so," he replied. "Some men just aren't made for paperwork." He looked sourly at the litter on his table. "Sometimes I think a fire in here might solve the problem. I'm sure the clerks in Krellos wouldn't even miss all my reports." He looked curiously at Sparhawk's companions. "My man Curic," Sparhawk introduced his squire. "Curic?" the abbot nodded. "And the lady is Sophrenia, the Pandian instructor in the secrets." "Sophrenia herself?" The abbot's eyes widened, and he rose to his feet respectfully. "I've been hearing stories about you for years, madam. Your reputation is quite exalted." He smiled broadly at her in welcome. She removed her veil and returned his smile.
"You're very kind to say so, my lord."
She sat and gathered flute up into her lap. The little girl nestled down and regarded the abbot with her large, dark eyes.
A beautiful child, Lady Sophronia, the abbot said. Your daughter, by any chance? She laughed.
Oh, no, my lord abbot, she said. The child's a Styric foundling. We call her Flute.
What an odd name, he murmured. Then he returned his gaze to Sparhawk. You hinted at a matter you wanted to keep private, he said curiously. Why don't you tell me about it? Do you get much news about what's happening on the continent, my lord?
I'm kept informed, yes. The bearded abbot said it rather cautiously as he sat down again.
Then you know about the situation in Elenia.
The queen's illness, you mean, and the ambitions of Primate Annius.
Right. Anyway, a while back, Annius came up with a very complicated scheme to discredit the Pandian Order. We were able to thwart it. After the general meeting in the palace, the preceptors of the four orders gathered in private session. Annius hungers for the archprelate's throne, and he knows that the militant orders will oppose him. With swords, if necessary, the abbot agreed fervently. I'd like to cut him down myself, he added. Then he realized that he had perhaps gone too far. If I weren't a member of a cloistered order, of course, he concluded lamely.
I understand perfectly, my lord, Sparhawk assured him. The preceptors discussed the matter, and they concluded that all of the primate's power, and any hope he had of extending it to Krellos, is based on his position in Elenia, and he'll keep that authority only for so long as Queen Alana's indisposed. He grimaced. That's a silly word, isn't it? She's barely clinging to her life, and I called it indisposed. Oh well, you know what I'm talking about.
We all flounder from time to time, Sparhawk. The abbot forgave him. I know most of the details already. Last week I got word from Patriarch Domont about what was afoot. What did you find out in Barata?
We talked with the physician there, and he told us that Queen Alana has been poisoned.
The abbot came to his feet, swearing like a pirate.
You're her champion, Sparhawk. Why didn't you go back to Samura and run your sword through Annius?
I was tempted, Sparhawk admitted, but I decided that it's more important right now to see if we can find an antidote. There'll be plenty of time later to deal with Annius, and I'd rather not be rushed when it gets down to that. Anyway, the physician in Barata told us that he thinks the poison is of Rendorish origin, and he directed us to a couple of his colleagues here in Cypria. The abbot began to pace up and down, his face still dark with rage. When he began to speak, all traces of monkly humility were gone from his voice.
If I know Annius, he's probably been trying to stop you every step of the way, am I right?
Fairly close, yes.
And the streets of Cypria aren't the safest place in the world, as you found out that night 10 years ago.
All right then, he said decisively. This is the way we're going to do it.
Annius knows that you're looking for medical advice, right?
If he doesn't, then he's been asleep.
Exactly. If you go near a physician, you'll probably need him for yourself, so I won't let you do that.
Won't let, my lord?
Sophronia asked mildly.
Sorry, the abbot mumbled. Maybe I got a little carried away there. What I meant to say is that I advise against it in the strongest possible terms. What I'll do instead is send some monks out to bring the physicians here. That way you'll be able to talk with them without chancing the streets of Cypria. We'll work out a way afterwards to slip you out of town.
Would an Elenian physician actually agree to call on a patient at home?
Sophronia asked him.
He will, if his own health is of any concern to him, the abbot replied darkly.
He suddenly looked a bit sheepish.
That didn't sound very monkly, did it? He apologized.
Oh, I don't know, Sparhawk said blandly. There are monks, and then there are monks.
I'll send some of the brothers into the city to fetch them right now. What are the names of these physicians?
Sparhawk fished the scrap of parchment the tipsy doctor in Barata had given him out of an inside pocket and handed it to the abbot. The bluff man glanced at it.
You know this first one already, Sparhawk, he said. He's the one who treated you the last time you were here.
Oh, I didn't really catch his name.
I'm not surprised. You were delirious most of the time.
The abbot squinted at the parchment.
This other one died about a month ago, he said. But Dr. Voldy here can probably answer just about any question you might have. He's a little impressed with himself, but he's the best physician in Cypria.
He rose, went to the door, and opened it. A pair of youthful monks stood outside. They were, Sparhawk noted, quite similar to the two young Pandians who normally stood guard outside Vanyan's door in the chapter house in Simura.
You, the abbot sharply ordered one of them. Go into the city and bring Dr. Voldy to me. Don't take no for an answer.
At once, my lord,
the young monk replied. With a certain amusement, Sparhawk noted that the monk's feet twitched slightly, as if he were about to snap his heels together. The abbot closed the door and returned to his seat. It should be about an hour, I expect. He looked at Sparhawk's grin. Something funny, my friend? He asked.
Not at all, my lord. It's just that your young monks have a very crisp manner about them.
Does it really show that much? The abbot asked, looking a little abashed.
Yes, my lord, if you know what you're looking for, it does.
The abbot made a wry face. Fortunately, the local people aren't very familiar with that sort of thing. You'll be discreet about this discovery, won't you, Sparhawk?
Of course, my lord. I was fairly sure about the nature of your order when I left here 10 years ago, and I haven't told anyone yet.
I should have guessed, I suppose. You Pandians tend to have very sharp eyes.
He rose to his feet.
I'll have some supper sent up. There's a fairly large partridge that grows hereabouts, and I have an absolutely splendid falcon, he laughed. That's what I do instead of making out the reports I'm supposed to send to Krellos. What do you say to a bit of roast fowl?
I think we could manage that, Sparhawk replied.
And in the meantime, could I offer you and your friend some wine? It's not Arcean red, but it's not too bad. We make it here on the grounds. The soil hereabouts isn't much good for anything but raising grapes.
Thank you, my lord abbot, Sophrenia replied. But might the child and I have milk instead?
I'm afraid that all we have is goat's milk, Lady Sophrenia, he apologized. Her eyes brightened.
Goat's milk would be just fine, my lord. Cow's milk is so bland, and we Styrix prefer something a bit more robust.
Sparhawk shuddered. The abbot sent the other young monk to the kitchen for milk and supper, then poured red wine for Sparhawk, Kyrick, and himself. He leaned back in his chair then, idly toying with the stem of his goblet.
Can we be frank with each other, Sparhawk? He asked.
Of course. Did any word get to you in Jirok about what happened here in Cypria after you left?
Not really, Sparhawk replied.
I was a bit submerged at that time. You know how Rendors feel about the use of magic.
Sparhawk nodded. They call it witchcraft, as I recall.
They do indeed, and they look on it as a worse crime than murder. Anyway, just after you left, we had an outbreak of that sort of thing. I got involved in the investigation since I'm the ranking churchman in the area. He smiled ironically. Most of the time, Rendors spit as I go by, but the minute somebody whispers witchcraft, they come running to me with their faces white and their eyes bulging out. Usually the accusations are completely false. The average Rendor couldn't remember the Styric words of the simplest spell if his life depended on it, but charges crop up from time to time, usually based on spite, jealousy, and petty hatreds. This time, though, the affair was quite different. There was actual evidence that somebody in Cypria was using magic of a fair degree of sophistication.
He looked at Sparhawk.
Were any of the men who attacked you that night at all adept in the secrets?
One of them is, yes.
Perhaps that answers the question, then. The magic seems to have been part of an attempt to locate something, or someone. Maybe you were the object of that search.
You mention sophistication, my lord abbot, Sophrenia said intently. Could you be a bit more specific?
There was a glowing apparition stalking the streets of Cypria, he replied. It seemed to be sheathed in lightning of some kind.
She drew in her breath sharply. And